upward like a cat stalking a bird. Its back scraped against the ceiling of the arcaded corridor, damaging the stonework and causing large cracks. The floor was also suffering under a weight load it had never been designed to bear. Iheart had reached the tip of the tail and was unsure how to proceed. Shall I overtake it and attack from below? Shall I hack at the tail tip and attack when it turns round? Before he could come to a decision, the Cordrian suddenly slipped into the next vertical shaft and disappeared.
What are you looking for, bug eyes?
Iheart was now at the edge and could see the monster several levels beneath him, creeping back into the building.
You're looking for something, that's for sure.
He turned and found a long flag hanging from the wall. Pulling it away, he wrapped one end round a column and used it to climb to the floor that the Cordrian had selected. When he landed, he took out his crow's beak again.
You're not getting away from me that easily.
Slynn and Balindar slid down the flag to arrive behind Iheart. They were breathless from the effort as the three of them pursued the monster. The Cordrian encountered no resistance. The Alphar had never reckoned with a creature like this breaking into their city. The dwarves passed bitten off limbs and pools of blood or smashed and mutilated bodies. These were the simple inhabitants of the town, as could be seen by the clothing they had worn. They had neither weapons nor armor at their disposal.
It's gone off to the right, called Balindar. Over there in the wide passage.
I can see for myself, growled Iheart,
who had grown tired of all this chasing about. He wanted a proper fight and was not interested in completing an endurance test. They rounded the corner and were confronted with a broad gap in the walls, forming a path through to the gate they had entered by. And that was where the Cordrian was heading, still crouching low against the ground. Its back scraped some of the hanging gardens, making them sway and come away from their anchorages so that soil and plants rained down. Its claws hurled any Alphar aside who had not sought cover. Some of them the creature gobbled up or chewed to get at their blood, spitting out the remnants.
Ho!
Shouted Iheart, hurrying onwards as fast as his legs could carry him.
Ho, you with the ugly face! Stand still for a change!
What's it want of the gate?
Balindar did not seem so bothered by all the running.
So it's not you it's trying to follow, Doubleblade.
Slynn dropped behind.
Don't wait for me, he panted. I'll catch up. This armor is so heavy.
Iheart grabbed him by his forearm protectors.
You are a child of the smith. Make a bit of an effort. You need to win your share in the glory of killing the Cordrian. When will a fourthling ever get a chance like this again?
Secretly, he was wondering where on earth Tungdil and Aepherton had got to. He stepped over the debris and piles of sand from the hanging gardens. They kept having to make detours round broken lumps of masonry that had fallen from the façade. The vibrations caused by the Cordrian's progress, together with the violent swinging of its powerful tail, were destroying Phocion.
It's got to the gate!
Slynn could hardly speak. He was so out of breath. They were 100 paces behind their quarry.
I'm done for.
He stopped and rested his crossbow on a tree trunk.
I'll cover you from here.
Iheart and Balindar hurried on.
Have you got a plan?
Asked the fifthling.
Yes, to kill it, replied Iheart. The simplest plans are always the best ones.
They reached the open square in front of the gate. The Cordrian turned and twisted as if possessed, crouching down and arching its back, and seizing the Black Squadron's ponies. The animals neighed loudly in terror and bolted, running chaotically about, but they could not escape the predator's claws. A slaughter ensued, and there was an overwhelming stink of fresh blood, with red smears and spatters on the walls.
The sandy floor was soaked. The dwarves had withdrawn to hide in the arcades and were bombarding the monster from undercover. A few of the Alfar soldiers were helping out, loosing their arrows or casting their lances or spears from the upper galleries.
So it doesn't like ponies.
Ireheart was surprised.
Is that why it's not bothering with the murderer of its own young?
Balindar had been looking around and had found a pack horse that was attracting the Cordrian's attention.
Look over there! It's not attacking that one!
Maybe it likes horses?
Ireheart attempted a joke, but grew serious.
I know what you mean. That's the one Tirigan sent us. Did the Alf get our provisions confused with the Cordrian's feed? Let's have a look and see what's really in there.
Balindar followed him. In the meantime, three of the firing towers on the roof had rolled forward to the edge. The barrage was now becoming dangerous for the mighty beast. More and more Alfar were in the courtyard, and soon the Cordrian was losing blood from countless wounds. It gave a maddened scream, thrashing with its tail and causing untold damage.
But it's not trying to escape, although it must know that every minute spent here brings it closer to death.
Ireheart was quite near to it now. One of the talons touched the packhorse, but very cautiously. Ireheart had caught up. With a vicious swipe of the crow's beak, he attacked the long, investigating finger.
That stays here!
He yelled furiously, yanking the handle of his weapon. With a loud tearing sound, the blade ripped through the pale grey skin.
That's our horse!
Balindar leaped in, smashing his morning star down onto the claw so that blood gushed out. With a screech, the Cordrian pushed forward and tried to spread its wings, but the surrounding walls made this impossible. However, the very attempt caused further destruction.
Look out!
Ireheart pulled Balindar aside as a large lump of heavy plasterwork threatened to fall straight on top of him.
Even the best of helmets won't save you from that kind of thing.
The Cordrian snapped at them, and the dwarves ducked to avoid its ugly mouth. Ireheart used the opportunity to strike one of its lower eyes. The eye immediately burst open, and the creature bellowed with pain. The spike had buried itself in a bone. Ireheart did not release his hold on the weapon and was dragged upwards as the creature raised its head. The swift movement made him giddy and drove the air out of his lungs, leaving him gasping like a landed carp, but he didn't let go.
I won't be shaken off! He called. Is that all you can do? A bit further, you hideous freak. You won't scare me. I can take the altitude.
Then an arrow got him in the left foot.
Cursed black eyes! He yelled. Can't you aim straight like your northern relatives?
His arms grew heavy, and his own weight, together with that of the armor, dragged at him. But to let go would be instant death. Then he saw Aepherton leap out of a window 7 floors above the Cordrian's back, his spear tip targeting the creature's neck.
With that thing?
Ireheart could not believe it.
Oh, Vrakus! He's got a little needle! He's going to prick it with a little needle!
The monster ducked and shook its head. The crow's beak spike came loose, and the dwarf flew off to the right through the air like a missile 4 paces above the ground, landing in a heap of butchered ponies whose steaming intestines cushioned his fall. He struggled up in a rage, broke off the arrow under the sole of his foot and stood.
Now you've really made me mad.
The red mask of battle fury was setting in. Only the Cordrian was unmoved.
I'll give you such a battering, I'll have you in pieces!
Aepherton had leaped onto the creature's back and was stabbing away through the spinal column, finding the spaces between the huge vertebrae. The Cordrian arched up with a screech, and Tungdil jumped down onto it from one of the lower galleries, ramming Bloodthirster into a different place on the backbone, paralyzing the creature's right leg. It fell to its knees and lurched against the east facade, breaking the wall down. The building above it collapsed, covering the Caudrium with a hail of heavy masonry. Eferton and Tungdil had taken refuge just in time and were waiting on a balcony on the western side. But the beast was nowhere near the end of its strength. Thrashing its tail, it destroyed the gate and stonework above, killing dozens of Alfar who fell with the collapsing wall to be crushed by falling chunks of masonry, while others were hit by the tail and hurled through the air to fall, broken, to the ground. The beast rose from the debris with a cry. It staggered and crashed headfirst into a wall. Ironheart had reached the Caudrian again.
"You'll be quiet soon enough."
He swung his arm back and whacked his crow's beak into the area of the soft underbelly where, he supposed, the genitals to be. The skin ripped open, and the monster uttered a shrill cry.
"Ha! That's what I like to hear,"
Ironheart bellowed merrily.
"Let's have another!"
He repeated his winning strike.
"Sing it for me again!"
Eferton and Tungdil moved in to help the sturdy warrior finish the beast off. They had to keep dodging the wildly flailing, taloned limbs. Its vast wings opened and closed convulsively, causing yet more damage to the fabric of Phocion.
"Stop now!"
Ironheart clambered boldly up the creature's long neck and brought the spike of his weapon forcefully down through the Caudrian's skull.
"Let's have you dead, you wretched fiend."
And now, indeed, the vast body of the Caudrian slumped. With a last groan, it thrashed its tail for a final time, then fell over, destroying more of the buildings. Clouds of dust rose up. Ironheart used his plait to wipe away the sweat and other unpleasant liquids from his forehead and beard. But there was too much of it. He was merely smearing it over his face, as if he had been using a paintbrush. There would have to be a bath, a shallow one, though.
"By Vracus, the dwarves done good!" he crowed, lifting his weapon so that the Caudrian blood dripped off it.
Close by, he saw his one-eyed friend nodding approvingly. Eferton was back down on the ground, staring up at the bulk of the huge beast. There were still occasional bumps, bangs, and crashes as more of the plaster and brickwork came down. The distress of any surviving ponies could also be heard, mixed with the moans of the wounded. Then there was a single cry of relief, taken up by more and more of the Alfar, as they realized the creature had been slain. The call echoed in chorus through the alleys and ravines of the city.
Ironheart clambered over the neck and onto the belly to join Tungdil. "I don't get what they're saying, but it sounds as if they like us," he said brightly,
lowering the crow's beak and putting both hands on the shaft. He looked extremely pleased with himself.
"At last, my kind of adversary. There won't be many dwarfs who can outdo my deeds today."
He looked around, and through the settling dust saw the faces of the Alfar rejoicing. Tungdil slapped him on the shoulder.
"Well done, Ironheart. They are saying, don't tell me, scholar," he interrupted. "That way I can imagine the Black Eyes are adoring me instead of wanting to kill me."
He looked down at his injured foot, where the feathered arrow shaft still stuck up through the boot.
"Perhaps that was one of them trying it on just now."
Tungdil laughed and started to climb down.
"Come on! I want to find out what Eferton has to say about our help."
At sunset, Tungdil, Ironheart, Slin, Balindar, Hargerin, and Baskalin assembled in the Emperor's throne room. Five of the Zadar came along as well. They were invited to sit at a table where goblets and jugs of wine stood ready. Nothing was poured out yet. Beforehand, Eferton had arranged for them to be shown to chambers where they could rest from their exertions. They met up in the room they had first seen on arrival. The paintings on the walls had changed. The black and white silhouette designs were now full-color floor-to-ceiling landscapes of absurd beauty, and if you look carefully, the shrubs and trees were not depictions of real plants, but were made up of tiny painted corpses, with wounds and cut throats.
"Just as balmy as their relations," said Ironheart in disgust. "But that ointment they gave us really works. I can hardly feel the hole in my foot."
"Who knows what it's made of?" muttered Slynn. "But I'm not complaining. They treated me like a king."
"Apart from the bath," murmured Ironheart. "I had to get rid of most of the water before I got in. It was nearly up to my knees."
"You mean because of Elria and her water curse?" Slynn's face bore a broad grin. "I've never heard of a dwarf drowning in a bath."
"And I didn't want to be the first."
He lifted his hand to show the amount of water for a proper bath.
"From my fingertips to my wrist, that's all it needs."
Slynn burst out laughing.
"That's only about enough to wet your manliness."
"I understand the Fourthlings are smaller in all areas than the other tribes," Balindar threw in.
"My bolt always reaches the target. I can always hear it hit home," said Slynn, pointing to the morning star. "But you will be built like your weapons. Too much force in the balls, and only a little spike."
Ironheart roared with laughter. Aferton's entrance put a swift end to the dwarves' banter. He shook everyone's hands, except for those of the Zadar, then took his seat at the head of the table. Two Alfar came up to pour out a variety of wines. The Emperor studied his visitors closely, his eye sockets black as night.
"So he does not wish to put aside the blemish, or perhaps he can't,"
Ironheart wondered.
"You and your friends have amply demonstrated that you are not among Fosian's enemies."
Aferton's voice was calm and steady as he raised his cup in salute.
"For this, and your support in our hour of need, I thank you."
He drank a toast to them.
"The Cordrian young we found on the pack horse have been smuggled into our train," replied Tungdil. "In my view, Turrigan is the only one who could have done this. And that means that at least one of the Jon Aklan is against you."
He looked at the Emperor expectantly. Aferton slowly replaced his goblet.
"Your tone suggests to me that you know more, Tungdil."
He gestured to his Alfar to leave the chamber, then ran his eyes over the dwarf faces.
"Before we go on, I should like to ask that only those permitted to hear all the truth remain in the room with us."
Tungdil nodded, but continued.
"As some of them still do not trust me because I returned after 250 cycles of forced exile, and they doubt my integrity, I shall not ask anyone to leave the room. I want all of them to hear what the Emperor of the Alfar and the High King of the Dwarf Tribes have to say to each other."
Ironheart breathed a sigh of relief. He had feared that only he would be allowed to stay.
"That would have meant yet more bad blood."
"Our original plan was different,"
Tungdil began, after taking a swig of wine. He explained to the Alf leader what they had first intended to do with the Cordrian's young. He described what was waiting in the Black Abyss, and told him they needed Lot Ionan, and what they planned to do with the dragon and his treasure, to get the dragon to the Magus and provoke a war between them. Aferton listened with no sign of emotion.
"Things have happened differently," Tungdil summed up. "And a good thing, too, because I think the Southern Alfar will be better as our allies than as our foes when we march against Lot Ionan. That was what you were planning yourselves."
"To march against the Magus is pure suicide," answered Aferton soberly. "That is why I gave in to what my subjects from the south have been urging."
He poured himself more wine and smiled.
"I see you are surprised."
Ironheart looked around. Nobody spoke. So he said,
"I thought you meant to go to your own death."
Aferton leaned slightly forward, chin on his hand.
I never wished to be like my father. I always said that, and yet I have become like him. It would be too easy to find excuses for what I have done to Gerdlegard, but I admit it all. That is why I shall lead them to the south, to ensure their eradication in battle with Lotionen.
Hurrah! That's the right attitude!
Ironheart applauded in spite of himself, and then coughed to cover his embarrassment.
I have been dazzled for too many cycles, inebriated by my own power. I have made conquests, taken lives, and broken the will of the people. Not because I had to, but because I could. Because I was stronger,
the Emperor explained.
That terrible intoxication has passed now, but the memory of my guilt remains. With every new day I see the suffering I inflicted on Eidoslain, Urgon, and Goragar. It has to end. And I shall end it.
The Gjona clan and Northern Alfar won't follow you, Tungdil pointed out.
That is why I shall return alone from the Blue Mountains and destroy Jon Bara with my own hands. There are only a few hundred Alfar who gained entry to Gerdlegard through the secret passageway under the Moon Pond. I shall deal with them on my own.
As if to prove his intentions, the runes on his armor started to glow.
Your arrival and plan, Tungdil, have strengthened my resolve. Once the dragon is dead, nothing stands in the way of Gerdlegard's liberation.
He closed his eyes, and a red tear emerged from under the lid and made its way down his cheek.
I never wanted to be like the Unslayables. My words shall at last be matched by my deeds.
Ironheart tried to catch Tungdil's attention. The scholar returned his gaze.
It could not have worked out better,
was the silent message.
Would you be prepared to support us against the enemies from the Black Abyss?
Tungdil asked.
A warrior such as yourself?
Aferton shook his bald head.
When I have wiped out my own race, my debt of guilt to Gerdlegard will have been settled. I led the Alfar into Gerdlegard, and I shall free the humans from that yoke again. Without the oppression they have suffered, the humans will be prepared to follow you in battle to the outer lands to defend their new-won freedom.
He opened his eyes again.
I suggest that I announce to the Alfar that we have signed a peace treaty with all the dwarf tribes, and not only with the Thirdlings. You must swear to me that nothing of what I have said will get out.
Of course, for our own sakes, promised Ironheart.
Speaking for them all.
If the Black Eyes got wind of your plan and opted to stay here instead of going to fight the Magus, we'd have a much tougher task to get rid of them.
He grinned and gave thanks to Vrakus. This was all turning out so much better than he could have assumed when the journey started. Balindar stared at Aferton.
What about you? When all the Alfar are dead, what will you do?
He drew a deep breath.
I shall go away, to the east, to see what I shall find. I swear that I shall never return to Gerdlegard, unless, of course, I am invited.
He smiled at Tungdil.
For whatever reasons. And with the help of your gods and mine, he raised his goblet in a toast, the last remaining northern Alfar and I shall die together.
Tungdil bowed to him.
My respect for your courage, Aferton. I see that I was not mistaken in you.
He stood up.
With your permission, we shall now withdraw. On the morrow, we shall head for the Red Mountains to test the waters with the dragon. For him and his orcs, we shall lay a trail he can't ignore.
By the time he arrives, I should be in the Blue Mountains with the army. Lotionen and his Famuli won't find my troops easy to contend with, but they will be victorious. Then the dragon and the orcs will arrive just in time to take on the Magi.
Aferton also got to his feet.
But have a care that Loisbrand does not turn Lotionen into a glowing torch. The Scaly One is very powerful.
He managed to subjugate Queen Wei the 11th, a mighty ruler with the reputation of being a great Magar. If Lot Ionin is killed, you will be faced with the problem of cleansing the Black Abyss on your own.
Tungdil's eye narrowed.
Is she still alive?
Queen Wei, yes, as far as I know. And she has a daughter said to be good at magic.
The elf had understood the reason behind the question.
They would make excellent allies once the dragon has been vanquished. If Lot Ionin were to die, she would be my first choice to aid us against the monsters in the outer lands.
He shook hands with the dwarves once more.
May Vrakas be with you. If fate wills it, we shall meet again.
Aferton left the throne room.
Onwards and upwards. Vrakas, we shall do heroic deeds.
Ireheart helped himself to water, drank, and belched, patting himself on the belly.
Bed now, scholar. We'll have an early start in the morning. Off to relieve the dragon of his treasure. And to pay our respects to a lady sorceress, I understand.
Tungdil laughed.
Off to bed.
Girdlegard, former Queendom of Wayern, Lake Pride. Late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. By the large round window in her mother's study, Coira sat staring out at the lake. The white morning veil on her hair and the black of her high-necked dress made her look older, Rodario thought. He was sitting next to her, fidgeting with a quill pen. Millennia was pacing up and down with her hands clasped behind her back. The carpet muffled the sound of her steps, but the regular click-clack of her boot heels could still be heard. The actor laid the feather quill aside and attempted to look the young Magar in the eyes, but noted her fresh tears. He had a thin bandage round his neck, chiefly for decoration and as a souvenir of the wound Sisseroth had inflicted on him. The blade had slipped on the antique pendant he wore, and this had taken the force of the blow.
Princess, it was not your fault.
The Alfar set a trap for you, said Rodario gently. If you had been a swordswoman, something similar could have happened with your weapon. The Alfar know how to deceive and trick. You could not have prevented it.
That, she said with a sob in her voice, is your fifth attempt to convince me that my mother did not die as a result of my incompetence. But again you failed to get me to change my opinion of events.
She stared at her hands.
These are what I killed her with. These hands and the wretched magic she taught me herself.
You were trying to kill the elf, he began. But she whirled round.
But who is it lying in the crypt next to my father? The elf? She cried in despair. I must never use magic again.
But you saved Millennia's life with your magic spell, he protested, trying a different tack.
And who will protect your subjects against the dragon if he turns up here? Don't abandon your skills, princess.
Yes, I must, she whispered, her anger fading now. She looked out at the lake again.
To be doubly sure, I should destroy the source before Lot Ionin or the Alfar can use it.
You want to demolish the shaft? Millennia had stopped pacing and her eyes were flashing.
I know you are grieving. I, too, have lost many relatives, but I'm not using that as an excuse to crawl away and hide and bewail my fate.
Coira did not even look at her.
Go back to Idaslane, Millennia, she advised her in a flat voice. It was when you arrived here that everything started to go wrong in Lake Pride. If only I had not listened to this third-rate actor, the Alfar would have caught and killed you. Then everything would have been different.
It's a waste of time going over it again and again, Rodario said, throwing Millennia a warning glance to discourage her from making a sharp retort.
You are Wayan's new queen.
It's Lohasbrand who is the ruler, in case you had forgotten, she interrupted coldly. All I am is an incompetent maker, sitting on a rock in the middle of a shrinking lake, having extinguished the life of my own mother.
Rodario sighed. It was the Alf who decapitated her.
But it was me who injured her so badly that she could not defend herself. Can't you understand?
Where did the Alfar go? Is there any trace? Millennia asked.
I've missed a lot. It's taken me a long time to recover.
Sisseroth has left the island. At least he won't be coming back to try to kill us. And where his sister is, only the waters know.
Rodario sounded impatient. He was keen to be raising Koira's spirits, not making reports for Millennia. Koira was Gerdlegard's last Maegha and must not be permitted to cast her powers aside in this way. But she was so grief-stricken that no one could expect her to listen to reason. Since the death of her mother, she had not bathed in the magic source, and her inner reservoir must be practically exhausted by now, after the combat with the Alfar and the effort of saving Millennia. He dared to come closer to her.
Princess, how do you think I feel?
Did you bring about your mother's death through your own stupidity?
No.
Then you have no idea what I'm going through, she said, her voice wavering.
I can hear her screams when it's quiet. And when I look in the mirror, I can see her face on fire. If someone lays a fire and I smell the smoke, it makes me vomit.
She closed her eyes and held her hands in front of her face.
The Alf should have killed me in her place, Koira sobbed.
Rodario cared not a fig for the difference in status between them. He took her in his arms and pulled her to him, pressing her head against his chest. She threw her arms around him and sobbed her heart out. Millennia sat near the door and said nothing. She knew the value of such comfort. But to her surprise, she suddenly felt jealous. For some reason she had become besotted by this weakling of an actor. Probably because he was so gloriously unmacho and so different from every man she had ever known. The kiss he had stolen from her had only confirmed what her soul had long known. She watched Rodario rocking the princess in his arms.
I can't ever tell him. Everyone would laugh at us, she thought, unhappily. Look, here comes the warrior maiden with her lapdog Rhymester. Anyone her swords cannot conquer, he bores to death with the power of his tongue.
Despite her unhappiness, the very thought made her grin. She tried to distract herself by thinking about the Alfar twins. Millennia had the corpse of the Alfar woman in her mind's eye. They had found it floating in the lake, but before they could reach it, it had sunk. She had clearly seen that Ferusha's breast and belly had been split open. She had initially survived the extremely serious injuries the Maegha had inflicted on her and had died from the impact when she fell. Probably Sisseroth had gone to search for his sister or for her body. Perhaps there was a special Alfar ritual he was following. This delay could give them a much-needed respite from attack. And no one knew how the dragon was going to react. He had not yet sent an answer. There came a knock at the door. Loiten entered, without waiting, and was already in the room before freezing at the sight of Rodario and the princess, locked in an embrace.
"How dare you, you jumped-up little actor!" he exclaimed, his voice husky with indignation. "Get your hands off the queen this instant. Come outside if you're man enough, and I'll show you how to behave."
Millennia coughed to announce her presence.
"You've chosen the wrong moment for insisting on social niceties, Count Loiten," she told him. "Calm down."
She saw the letter in his hand.
Is that Loisbrand's reply?
And what is that to you?
She frowned impatiently.
When you have collected yourself and can think, you may remember that I am from the highborn race of the Ido, Count, she retorted boldly. I am entitled to be addressed as the regent of Eiderslane. If you are as keen on etiquette and the proprieties as you would have us believe, then you will greet me with a sweeping bow every time you come into my presence, and you will call me Your Highness.
She saw him grow red, Is that the way you want it, cunt?
He was stony-faced with anger.
I have not opened the letter, he responded. And yes, it is from Lohasbrand.
He went over to put the missive on the desk.
Koira freed herself from Rodario's arms and wiped the tears from her face. Thank you, she said, and opened the envelope.
Her eyes quickly scanned the lines, and a fragment of dragon scale fell out onto the wooden desk. This was proof that the letter contained authentic instructions from Lohasbrand.
And?
Rodario tried to glimpse the contents over her shoulder in a manner inappropriate for a man of his class. Loiten shot him a murderous glance and clenched his fists.
He commands me to search for the Alf and to take him prisoner. To this end he is sending 100 orcs for my use, she summarized, and he insists on my taking an oath of allegiance.
That would mean being constrained with a collar like your mother, said Rodario, horrified, surrounded by 4 guards, abjuring magic completely.
I don't care. That way I shall never be tempted to get back down to the lakebed to reinforce my powers, she answered dully.
Majesty, you mustn't. Millennia was beside herself. You are the last of all the Maegar.
Koira's countenance darkened.
So what?
Rodario cursed under his breath. Millennia had done the one thing he had been trying to avert, and he saw that the Queen now would not be persuaded to change her mind.
It has been a difficult day, and we were all overexcited. Let's get some sleep. We can discuss this tomorrow.
Who are you to talk to Her Majesty like that? Raged Loiten. You'll not be discussing anything with anyone.
Then he glanced at Millennia, fearing a reproof.
Rodario is right.
Koira dried her tears.
I am exhausted and need to rest. Let us meet in the morning to talk about what the future holds.
All of us, she repeated emphatically, passing close by the actor as she left the room.
He heard her whispered,
Thank you.
And then she was gone, followed by Loiten.
Rodario stared out of the window for some time before setting off for his own chamber, taking a detour via the open, arcaded walk.
He loved the freshness that came from the lake waters.
He would never have believed himself capable of driving the Alf away with his fire seed's trick.
He thought it more likely that the Black Eye had retreated in private sorrow over the sister's death.
Sisseroth had killed 18 grown men before making off.
May Ferusha rot at the bottom of the lake, he wished.
Lost in thought, he had not noticed someone stepping out of the shadows. Only when the new arrival coughed did Rodario pay any attention.
Loiten, I didn't expect to find you here,
he lied brightly.
Is it time for that beating now?
Count Loiten came nearer.
When I chucked you into the lake, I should have shackled you first, stage scum.
He pointed down at the water.
This time that won't be necessary. A fall of 80 paces should be sufficient to break your neck. Then there's an end to your play acting. You will not be missed.
You took me by surprise last time, Count. Do you think you could do the same thing now?
Loiten laughed in his face.
Without your theatre tricks, you're nothing, nothing at all,
he taunted, fitting knuckle dusters over his hands. Rodario grinned.
But you don't seem to be relying on hitting me unaided. Do you think my chin is that hard?
I don't want to have to touch vermin like you more than once, that's all,
the Count retorted.
And how have I made you so jealous? I was only comforting Koira. Does your Lady Countess know about your private passion for Weyand's new queen?
Rodario was enjoying pouring oil onto the fire. It was always easier to fight an adversary who was beside himself with anger.
I'd be happy to inform her.
There'll be nothing left of you able to utter a single word.
Loiten moved swiftly, but the actor stepped backwards.
Stay where you are, ordered the Count.
If you insist, Rodario sighed, but I warn you, if you attack me now,
No one will ever see you again, not even your lady wife.
Dream on, idiot, and anyway, she already hates me.
Loiten launched a blow, and his fist met thin air.
On stage you have to be agile and move quickly.
Rodario had simply done a forward roll between his attacker's legs and had sprung upright. He kicked the count on the behind, making him stagger.
What's the matter? Was that all you had in mind?
Loiten struck out again.
Saw that coming a mile off.
Rodario blocked the charging fist, and his arm did not even quiver as he pushed his elbow into his attacker's face. Grabbing the man's hair, he dragged him down. At the same time, he propelled his knee at Loiten's nose. There was a crunch as the bone broke. Then he released his hold on Loiten and kicked him in the belly. The count fell groaning to his knees.
"I'll kill you for that," he croaked.
"Weren't you going to do that anyway?"
Rodario put on a look of surprise.
"And anyway, it's my turn to have a crack at murder now, not yours. For what you did out there at the shaft."
He watched Loiten toss away the knuckle dusters and draw a knife. Rodario dodged two attacks, ducked under a third, before showering a concerted hail of blows on his opponent, so that blood started pouring out of the cuts on his face. Loiten collapsed, fighting for breath.
"You know,"
Rodario explained to his injured rival, "when you're an actor, you need many talents. In order to portray a valiant warrior, for example, it's not enough simply to put on some armor. I have to actually be like a warrior, to fight like him, do you understand? I won't deny that it sometimes comes in very useful." Loiten dragged himself up on the wall, coughing and spluttering.
"That took more than a few hours to learn," he mumbled.
Three teeth lay on the floor.
Rodario made a bow. "Thank you for your kind words. You should see me fence. I'm a real master with the rapier."
He laughed.
"Another time, perhaps, when you feel like a duel again and have recovered from your injuries."
He thought for a moment.
"Now what was it that you were wanting to ask me?"
Loiten reached under his coat and threw a lump of cotton wool to the floor.
"I found this in your room." "Ah, yes, my stage props. What a discovery. You have your face padded out all the time, don't you? And that beard and moustache are only stuck on."
Loiten went on, wiping the blood off his mouth.
"Who are you really? Why do you keep up this masquerade from dawn to dusk?"
The expression in Rodario's eyes altered and became deadly serious.
"Curiosity has killed more than just a cat, my friend."
He took a sudden step forward, grabbing the count by belt and collar.
"So you'll be in good company."
He lifted the thin man and pushed him over the wall. There was no scream. "Maybe I didn't push him far enough out." Rodario leaned over the balustrade and saw Loiten four paces down, hanging by one hand from a drainpipe.
"Your excellent reflexes won't get you very far, except downwards."
He ran to a nearby brazier, the coals in it cold now, and started to drag it over to the wall. The count was still attempting to climb up the pipe.
"Wait! I'll throw you something to hold on to."
Grinning, he rolled the wrought iron container over the side.
"Here, catch! It'll take you quickly and safely to the bottom."
Rodario saw how the brazier smashed the pipe, plunging Loiten down toward the water. The iron basket followed at speed. No splash was audible from up here.
"Give my regards to the Alf woman," he called down.
Then he made sure that his actions had not been observed. The windows on that side were dark and the chambers unoccupied. Rodario allowed himself a broader grin as he picked up the cotton wool and stowed it under his coat. He preferred people to go on underestimating him. He was about to turn on his heel and continue on his way when he saw a vague outline against the evening sky. It looked at first sight like a bird. The nearer the shape came, the larger it grew, and the closer it came to the magic source, the surer Radario became that this was no bird, but...
Lohasbrand! He yelled and ran off. To arms! To arms! The dragon is coming!
Chapter 17. Girdlegard, former queendom of Wayern, 8 miles from Lake Pride. Late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. The Cordrian's assault had cost Tungdil 21 Black Squadron dwarves and 3 Zadar. They burned the bodies of the dead warriors and took their ashes to be buried back in the Red Mountains with all ceremony. Dwarf remains belonged in the mountains, not in a desert, and certainly not in an Alfar realm. But they had also lost the majority of the ponies. There was nothing for it but to cover the initial miles to the northwest border of Fosian Dwarmont on foot, before buying in more stock, bit by bit, from the farmers of the former kingdom of Tabain. It was inevitable that a marching column such as theirs would attract attention. Tungdil urged them on. Orbit for orbit, they marched on through the dried-up lake bed, now covered with ice and frozen fog, which crackled underfoot. They passed islands towering high on stalks, reminding Ironheart of huge stone mushrooms. There were also many small islands that had collapsed without the buoyancy provided by surrounding water. They had toppled over and broken apart.
It looks unreal, as if the gods were planning to make a new country.
Particularly fascinating were the places where reefs had been. They soared up like sharpened mountains, sometimes a good 100 paces high. The travellers came upon stranded wrecks of ships and the remains of mighty fish. The dwarves guided their ponies through the arched bones, which they could ride through without banging their heads. Such was the size of the skeletons.
I know now why I have always avoided deep water like the plague.
Ironheart looked at the fish, and at the thick skulls with their incisor-lined jaws. No prey would escape those sharp teeth.
You'd think our High King was trying to avoid any conflict with the Lohasbranders and the Orc contingents,
Slynn remarked as they rode along.
Yes, indeed, Ironheart agreed. But it's not a question of being frightened of battle, he stressed. It's about making swift progress. Our priority is to reach the Red Mountains and the Dragon's Hoard to relieve him of the most valuable pieces of treasure, so that he'll attack Lot Ionan in revenge.
So why the diversion to see Queen Wei the 11th in Lake Pride?
Slynn asked.
Could it be that you weren't paying attention? Because the scholar wants to suggest we wage a joint campaign against Lot Ionan as soon as the dragon and his orcs have left for the south, replied Ironheart. On the way back, when we're nicely loaded up with the dragon's valuables, we can come and collect her answer.
He looked around at the landscape.
This is the kind of lake I like, he said with satisfaction. Back home they'll be astonished when I tell them I've been walking around on the bottom of a lake and Elria can't get me.
Unless it rains, Slynn pointed out.
Ironheart gave him a suspicious glance.
What do you mean?
If it rains hard, the water won't soak in. It will collect on this hardened surface like in a dish.
If we happened to be at the deepest part of the dish at the time, we'd end up having to swim.
Slynn enjoyed catastrophizing. And we all know the dwarf race is none too good at swimming. Ironheart checked the sky. It was growing steadily darker.
Ruckus, send us anything. Send us molten rock. Anything but Elria's rain. Don't let her water us like a crop of peas.
Tungdil pointed.
We need to get back to the bank and head south. We should end up directly opposite Lake Pride. From there, it's only a short boat ride to the Magus Island.
Ironheart's good mood was now thoroughly dispersed. The thought of those fish skeletons came back to him.
Curses! So I shall have to set foot on a boat after all.
It's been fine so far.
Slynn attempted to cheer him up.
And so, what if we do fall in? I like a good bath.
That's because you're a pansy fourthling,
came the mocking response from under a helmet. It was a Zadar laughing at him. Ironheart remembered that coarse voice. It was the same warrior who had tried to provoke Slynn with remarks about bolt length when they were up on the roof. He fell back to come level with the armored voice.
Was that you just now?
Was that me, what? It was not the right voice.
No, it wasn't you. But you know who I mean. The one who's trying to stir things up. The troublemaker.
Ironheart pushed the man's visor up, a blackened face with a short beard. As a dwarf, Ironheart was finding it extremely difficult to tell one of these invisibles from another. The dye gave them all the same appearance. It was really a kind of protection to stop them being identified. No one would be able to describe an attacker.
"Whichever helmet you're hiding under," he called out, "hold your tongue! I won't have this sort of thing!"
He guided his pony to the front of the column again. Tungdil had already changed direction and was riding with Baskalin, heading for the dunes. The remnants of the lake must lie behind them. Ironheart urged his mount up. Its hooves sank in the loose dune sand. Then they reached the top and could see the edge of the lake. There was an island some 4 miles out, resting on a basalt stone pillar. To the left of it, iron walls could be seen rising out of the water.
"That's Lake Pride over there," said Tungdil. "We've arrived."
He pointed to the iron building.
"The source is underwater, so I suppose that's a mine shaft of some sort."
"Yes," said Balindar. "My mother sent her fithlings as a favor to help one of Weyand's queens with the construction."
"A masterpiece!"
Ironheart was extravagant in his praise.
"The pressure on the walls must be enormous."
Balindar did not conceal his pride in his tribe's achievement. "Our engineers put in the wall supports to keep the water out. If it were a marine environment, like in the Outer Lands, where there are tides to cope with, it wouldn't have worked."
"That's the advantage held by the Fithlings. They took in the best of all the tribes, and so they're way ahead with all the special skills the dwarves have,"
Slynn said generously. "I'd be interested in taking a look at that shaft. I can't really imagine what it must be like." Baskalin pointed out a village about 1/2 mile away. The upturned boats and fishing nets drying on the sand looked promising.
"We'll get ourselves a little fleet to take us over to the island."
Tungdil turned his pony's head toward the village.
"Or one boat that can take 10 of us. I don't want to arrive with the Black Squadron. You can get somewhere to stay in the village. We shan't be spending long with the Queen."
They galloped off to the village. Ironheart was not surprised to hear a tinny alarm bell greeting them. It sounded as if the bell itself was frightened.
"Not quite the joyful fanfare of welcome we're used to, is it, Scholar?"
he said, watching what the humans were up to.
"They're running to the lake!"
"They're launching the boats!"
Slynn pointed to those who were making a break for it.
"I bet they think we've been sent by the Alfar."
Balindar touched his own black armor.
"We don't really look like friendly visitors. The last time any dwarves were here will have been ages ago when they were building the shaft."
Hagarin laughed.
"They seem to know my Black Squadron."
"Send a couple of men over quickly to tell them we come in peace," Tungdil ordered.
"You're right, Balindar. I should have thought of that. We're spreading fear even when we don't want to. Back where I've come from, that would have been a good thing. But not here, I'm sorry."
Ironheart sent his friend an encouraging look.
"He really seems bothered about it."
Two of the Black Squadron rode ahead, calling out as they went. Ironheart looked up at the glowing evening sky before it disappeared into the gloom of night, and he made out the shape of a flying monster making for Lake Pride from the east. He could not say exactly what it was, but it was moving fast, and it looked pretty determined. He called out to Tungdil.
"You know more about monsters than I do. What is that?"
The dwarves watched as the creature approached the island and royal palace.
"I don't know," said the one-eyed dwarf.
but I don't think it's bringing Her Majesty a nice present. Then we're here right on time.
Slynn was getting excited.
We can help her, and then she'll be in our debt. We won't even have to ask her to come with us. She'll do it anyway because it will be the decent thing.
That's how I see it too.
Tungdil got the squadron to stop on the bank where the villagers were standing by the boats, listening suspiciously to their messengers.
Let's get ourselves over to the island.
Ironheart studied the water in apprehension as the waves lapped against the bank.
I hope Elria didn't hear me just now, he muttered into his beard, and that all the fish bigger than my little finger are now dead.
Rodario ran back into the palace and was relieved to note his warnings had been acted upon. Shouts came from all sides and alarm gongs sounded. Heavy boots thudded along the corridors. It was not only the fortress out at the shaft that was preparing for an attack. The defense positions here at the palace were also being manned. He reached Millennia's quarters, where he found her in the doorway, already in half her armor, buckling the leather straps.
Do you know what's happening?
That alarm is being sounded for me, he said proudly.
You? But you're not dangerous.
Millennia drew her sword and laughed.
No, seriously, do you know what all the commotion is about?
I saw something flying toward the shaft. I thought it would be wise to alert the palace so that they can greet the attacker properly.
He stopped, noticing that she was only half listening and was looking past him over his shoulder. Millennia lifted her arm.
Queen Koira, are you looking for us?
He turned to find the young Maegar hurrying toward them, surrounded by guards. She was wearing a black robe embroidered in white, her hair covered by the white veil.
It's the dragon, she cried. Lois Brand has arrived.
To attack us or to discuss what you wrote? Millennia sketched a curtsy. Rodario forgot to bow.
I don't know. Wasn't he going to send me 100 orcs to help capture the elf?
She ran on and waved them to follow her.
Where are you off to?
Rodario asked.
Is there a safe room at the bottom of the island's base where you can wait to see what happens?
I need to get to the magic source.
Don't make the mistake of destroying it without thinking carefully.
Nonsense, she interrupted.
I don't want to demolish the shaft. I haven't got enough magic in reserve to defend us against the scaly one.
Rodario and the Ido girl exchanged relieved glances.
We're pleased to hear you've made your decision. And it is down to the two of you that I am able to do this. I have thought a great deal about what you both said, and I agree that I must face up to my responsibilities. My mother will not have trained me in vain.
She gave them a brisk smile.
But it won't be easy. I'm not a fighter at heart.
She reached the platform from where the cable gondola could take her to the shaft. Koira was about to get in to the car, but Rodario held her back.
Wouldn't it be better to take the stairs? Our lives might hang from a rope.
It'll be fine.
The queen got into the gondola.
Trust me. I trust the construction, but not that dragon that's circling round the island.
He looked for the creature, but it was not visible.
Where has it got to?
It's underneath the island,
Millennia shouted, coming over.
Let's pray to Elria and Palandiel that we can get to the shaft in one piece.
Count Leuthen will cover us with his catapult fire.
Koira ordered four of the guards to join her, and the last of them shut the door after her as the steep downward trip began.
Count Leuthen is not at the fort, Highness, said one of the men. We met him up on the palace walls, but no one has seen him since.
Rodario was glad he had turned his face away. No one could read his expression. He considered himself a gifted enough actor to conceal his grin, but better safe than sorry. The gondola swayed in the evening breeze, and Millennia went very pale. The rocking movement was not too severe, however, as the anchoring bolts were all secure. It was all too slow for Koira's liking, and she told the guards to release the brakes a little further.
But, Your Highness, that'll mean we'll be too fast to stop at the landing stage.
The man risked an objection.
It's not safe to go any quicker.
The gondola had already dropped further away from the island when Rodario spied the creature again. There it is! It's hanging underneath the rock!
Millennia, Koira, and the soldiers leaned out for a better view. It was like a lizard with the wings of a grasshopper. The scaled body was 10 paces long, the mouth large enough to swallow